We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, out in cinemas this weekend is Transformers The Last Night, and we caught up with the star of the film, Mark Wahlberg. Here he is talking to us about the new elements in the film and Michael Bay's vision for the franchise.
For me, it's just about doing something different, you know. I didn't want to kind of repeat the same thing. And so once he sat down and actually I read the script in his office, I was really excited because it's a whole new world, a whole new universe. And I was excited. I think it's amazing the world that Michael has created, you know, and how believable and realistic it seems, and he continues to make them bigger and better. And with this, he's found an interesting way to kind of introduce some of the origin of the story, but also introduce and create new characters.
Here is Mark Wahlberg talking about working with Anthony Hopkins. I know when I heard Anthony Hopkins was in this movie, I thought, what in the name of good God is he doing in this? And then I thought, ah yeah, it's the big fat check. Well anyway, here is Wahlberg discussing with us what it was like to work with Anthony Hopkins.
He's a legend. But what was great about it is he's super prepared. You know, he was having the time of his life, and he's just such a sweetheart of a guy, you know, and willing to try stuff, you know. And that was fun because you never know, you know, if guys like that are, you know, take themselves too seriously. But it was a blast. It was a blast working with him. And again, you know, when you have those kind of talents, it really kind of helps to elevate the material as well.
Here is Anthony Hopkins now talking about his role in Transformers The Last Night. He was recently interviewed at Comic-Con, and this is what he had to say.
Well, I guess he's the thread of the driving force that gets their interest, Mark Wahlberg and Laura Haddock, the characters they play, to find out where Transformers, they think he's nuts. Well, I'm playing him as a kind of madman anyway.
That must have been fun.
Yeah, it's easy for me. I am mad.
That's really cool.
Now We Love Movies, let us hear from director Michael Bay talking about shooting the film in IMAX 3D.
We're the only movie this year to shoot in real 3D, which is sad. But studios are basically killing 3D because they're forcing directors to shoot post-convert everything. And they asked me, obviously, to post-convert. I said, no, then I'll give you a 2D movie. And, you know, there are not a lot of directors that are, make enough box office in the world to say no. And I put my foot down and said no. And I said, well, if we're going to do this 3D, we're also going to do this, we're going to do something that's never been done. We're going to take two Arri 65 cameras and strap them together and make true IMAX 3D. So it's the first time in the world that you will see true, real IMAX 3D.
Here is Michael Bay once again talking about trying to keep the Transformers franchise fresh and just trying to crack the story for the fifth installment.
Because I was going to walk away and from this franchise. And I proposed to Paramount, I said, listen, every time we do one of these, we have to roll the rock back up the hill. We need a real writer's room. So we've got 14 great writers. We put them through Transformer School. We put them in, lock them in a room for about a month at Paramount with 10,000 images from the franchise surrounded by props, a life-size thing of Bumblebee. It just stared them in the face. They came up with a complete Bible from the beginning of time to way deep into history. They came up with great stories. Spielberg and I gravitated to two stories, put them together. The guy who wrote Black Hawk Down is a writer of this, as well as the two guys who wrote First Iron Man. And it feels very fresh. I mean, we just had a super fan event at IMAX where I surprised them with some footage. Listen, I'm not giving a giveaway at the store, but I tease them with stuff.
Right.
And it, you know, they're hard to please, and they liked it.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now in We Love Movies, it is time to review Transformers The Last Night with Rory Cash. And before we do, here's just a little bit from the trailer.
It has been said through the ages, without sacrifice, there can be no victory. Two species at war.
That you have the most.
One flesh.
Beautiful face.
One metal. Optimus Prime has left us.
We're floating in space.
100 billion trillion planets in the cosmos.
Little section there from the trailer to Transformers The Last Night. Rory Cashin joins me in studio to review the film now. Rory, with a lot of these Transformers movies, the plot seems...
Don't you dare ask me to describe the plot, Gordon.
Rory, can you give some sort of semblance as to what's going on? Because they tend to get so convoluted for what should be really simple, take-your-brain-out type stories. But unfortunately, they tie themselves up in knots.
Yeah.
Now, I hear there's a King Arthur aspect to this. There's Nazis involved. Yeah. So there's a bit of time travelling going on.
No, there's no time travelling. No, it's just a linear time. Like, some of the Transformers... Now listen, right, so the first Transformers movie, we seen them crash land here, and they arrived, and there was like this whole, oh, aliens exist, and now in this movie we find out they actually crash landed here 1600 years ago, maybe longer, maybe even longer than that.
Right.
That's where King Arthur stuff comes in, and you find out Bumblebee, who, if I remember correctly, definitely did crash land here because he was Shia LaBeouf's car, the first one. Was fighting Nazis back in the 1940s, and is one of the reasons why the Allied team won World War II.
Mm.
But the overall plot, no, I can't even.
Because there's something.
I have it written down, and I look like a crazy person. I look like I need pins and like maps on the wall. I'm trying to describe, you know, why gravity doesn't exist, like to someone who's like, well, okay, well, we're gonna call the people in the white jackets and have you put in somewhere safe.
Rory, if anyone was listening to the start of the show, we mentioned that they've put together this, you know, high caliber writing team.
Mm.
Have any of their ideas essentially been gazumped by Michael Bay?
I genuinely don't know. Like, the plot of this feels like it's the plot of four films that has been smushed together.
Mm.
And then on top of that, Michael Bay has like these really over the like very Michael Bay-hem action sequences, and they're huge, and some of them. So one of them, I guess, is like kind of impressive, but like,
right.
I've been a Transformers apologist. In case anyone listening is like, oh well, it's Transformers, and of course critics are going to hate it anyway. I liked the first one.
Yeah.
The second one wasn't good, but I thought the bit in the desert with the giant destructor thing, I was like, that looks cool. The third one, the bit with the skyscraper falling on its side again, I was like, that looks cool. The attack in Chicago, like I could find things in each of them where it was like, yeah, like they're not. It's not like art. It's not good cinema, but, you know, you go and you eat popcorn and stuff explodes and that's fine. I cannot apologize for this one. I cannot argue its side because it is that bad. It is that convoluted. The action scenes are not good enough to make up for it. And it's just a mess. And it's just, it feels like everyone in it is both simultaneously not trying hard enough and trying way too hard.
Well, Mark Wahlberg looks embarrassed by the film. He just seems like he is there in body but not in mind when it comes to any of the junket interviews.
But he's really committed in the film, oddly enough.
Okay.
And he's putting as much effort into this as he did in The Patriots there at Deepwater Horizon. And he has decent chemistry with Laura Haddock, the lead female who was... the head of professor of like everything in Oxford, everything. She's a professor of everything in Oxford, but you know, she still gets called the B word and put in like very skimpy outfits when the time was required.
Well, that's
like, it's still Michael Bay.
Well, that's typical Michael Bay. And this is one of the things that I've really had issues with the Transformers movies. As someone who grew up loving them in the 80s and was a massive fan of the cartoons, the comics, then the toys and everything like that. And just with that first film, and I know we've spoken about it many times in the show before, you really felt that Steven Spielberg had a strong hold on that first film. And granted, it went off on a real Bay way toward the end of the film. He was laid off his lead, as it were. And there was way too many subplots and way too many characters, but you did feel the element of Spielberg.
Yep.
And then Michael Bay was given reins to just go off and do what you want.
Yeah.
And he's such a thin air for comedy. Plus, the objectification of women is disgraceful.
And the odd racism.
Oh my God, yeah. All the racial stereotypes as well that's
crazy,
going on. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like they haven't left this one either.
I've actually heard they're even worse in The Last Night.
They're as bad.
Okay.
They're as bad as they've ever been.
And then also, just sorry to cut across you, Rory, a lot of people will go in Optimus Prime and he's not in it very much.
He's done like a Vin Diesel in Fast 8 where for most of the... he's not involved in a huge amount of the action and he's gone bad for most of the plot and then, you know, it's Optimus Prime. How long is he going to stay bad? Like, I feel like this is a film that's impossible for me to spoil because... It's just that bad. It spoiled itself.
Well, we can only hope that Michael Bay sticks to his word and that this is his last film. Now, he has said that, I think, in the last three movies, that this would be his last outing. But you get the feeling this time he seems to be genuine. So, Rory, and we hopefully they will... They've left it on a bit of a cliffhanger for more films. So maybe with a new director at the helm, they can really get back to what was great about the Transformers. But now it's time to get your scores out of 10 for Transformers The Last Knight.
2.
Out of 10. Wow, there we go.
It's not good.
Oh, wow. That's got to be definitely one of the worst reviewed summer films we've had so far.
It's the worst film I've seen that cost that much money.
Oh, dear God. Yeah. That's pretty poor.
Is it as bad as the King Arthur film? I have to sit down and think about that. It's on par, I think.
I didn't have much time for that at all. Rory, thank you so much. Rory's going to be back a little later on as we're going to be discussing that Daniel Day-Lewis, he has decided he's going to retire from movies. That his next film with Paul Thomas Anderson, that's his last. He is done and dusted. Rory, we'll chat to you then.
Till then.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, out in cinemas in July is Christopher Nolan's brand new movie. It is called Dunkirk, and we're going to be talking about his filmography very shortly with Andy McCarroll. But first, here's a little bit from the trailer to Dunkirk.
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this sun. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
A little bit there from the trailer to Dunkirk. Joining me now is Andy McCarroll. Andy, as a matter of interest, why do you think Christopher Nolan just really stands out at the moment as one of the big A-list directors?
I think obviously the Batman films helped them from a commercial standpoint. A huge deal, like, you know, Dark Knight Begins, Dark Knight Rises, all made, you know, close enough to $1 billion each. But what stands out for me, he doesn't conform to any kind of studio system. He's not somebody who's found something that works for him and just made films like that. Like, he's gone from things like Memento to Batman to Inception, like very, very different films. And I think he's one of the few directors still working that's really taking chances on what they do and he's not happy settling in for, you know, second best. He's constantly trying to push the boundaries with the films that he's making. Some of them personally don't work for me, but I appreciate the fact that there is someone out there who is still trying to, you know, make new interest in films.
Now, let's just talk about some of the films in his filmography, because I know you've been writing about it. You've put together your own top 10 list of his flicks. Like, his first movie was The Following, which was pretty much like a student movie. Did you get a chance to see that at all?
Yeah, I did. I gone through my little art student phase when I got the, you know, Three Colors Blue, the likes of Following, just so I could be one of those annoying git who says, well, actually, Memento's not his first film. And it very much is kind of like a student film. It's, you know, it's like trying to judge Ronaldo on his time in Sporting Lisbon. You know, it's good, but you can see, you know, there's a lot of the stuff there that he brings to his later films. But as a film on its own, it doesn't stand out as much as his later work.
Now, Memento was the calling card. It was an incredibly well thought out, clever thriller. For those that haven't seen it, Andy, why was this one just a real standout and almost a film to make people sit up and take notice of Christopher Nolan's talent?
It just has everything that you want in like a thriller film. It's the kind of film that, you know, if you're asking for a recommendation from somebody, and you want, it's usually always you want an action comedy or you want a thriller, like a good thriller, and they haven't really made a lot of them. You know, Silence of the Lambs, Seven are the standouts. But the last 10 to 15 years, there hasn't been a real suspense thriller where, you know, the acting is great, the story is great, there's twists and turns keeping you interested the whole way through it. It's an absolutely perfect film for me. And I just think they don't make films like this anymore. They don't take those kind of mid-budget films, you know, where you haven't got a mass, like Guy Pearce at the time wasn't, probably still isn't, a massive star. And to just, you know, trust the story essentially and trust that people are going to be smart enough to follow it and people are going to be smart enough to find it as a film. And I think they've lost a lot of that in the last few years, the kind of rise of the superhero films and, you know, Transformers and things like that. But if you haven't seen Memento 100%, I'd absolutely recommend it.
I would definitely vouch for that too. It is a really good movie. It's so, so clever. He wrote it with his brother, Jonathan Nolan, I think based off of a short story that Jonathan wrote some years ago. Now, he followed that up with a movie that you consider to be an underrated gem. The film in question starred Al Pacino and the late Robin Williams, Insomnia. This is a remake, Andy.
It is a remake of a Norwegian film. And it's one of those, this is one of the lists that a lot of people were making in the comments saying they didn't realize it was a Christopher Nolan film or didn't realize, you know, this film existed. It's Robin Williams playing very much against type. I think it was the same year he had a one hour photo. He went through a kind of little villain phase. And it's so strange seeing him in this, you know, kind of creepy, you know, evil role that you're used to seeing, you know, the kind of happy-go-lucky Robin Williams. And he's really, really good in it. And you're watching this thinking, why didn't you do more things like this? Like, you really had a talent for it. Like, Al Pacino was one of the greatest actors of all time. And to be considered a viable nemesis for him in this film, which he is. Robin Williams is, you know, probably the best thing in that film. Like, he acts Al Pacino off the screen in it. And it's just a creepy little get in the film, essentially, and it's well worth a watch if you haven't seen it.
Now let's move on to the blockbusters, because once he did the gear change and managed to get his pitch for Batman commissioned by Warner Brothers, things just took on a completely new dimension for Christopher Nolan, because he was then really seen as this intelligent blockbuster filmmaker. And what he managed to do with the Batman movies was ground them in reality. Like, everything just had a basis for it. You could understand, oh yeah, that's how he would get the Batmobile. Of course it makes sense why he has these stealth-like skills, because he's essentially trained as a ninja. So, and everything in that world felt plausible. Now, we've spoken about this before, Andy, when it comes to his trilogy. For you, the standout movie is Batman Begins. What is it about that first film that stands out in comparison to the other two?
I just think this is the film where, if you were to take out the fact that it's like Batman, if you just take that out, it's just a great film from start to finish. Like, the points that you've touched on were kind of, you know, obviously a man dressing as a bat and fighting crime, no matter what way you ground it, it's still going to be a ridiculous storyline. It's completely implausible. But he does it in such a way that you forget that, and you just kind of have your suspension of disbelief. And it explains away some of the more, you know, ridiculous elements of the character. And I think it's done something that none of the other Batman films have done. It made Bruce Wayne the most interesting character. Usually you have, you know, like the Joker or Penguin, you know, they're kind of these flamboyant villains upstage him. But it really invested you in the story of, you know, essentially this, you know, spoiled brat who didn't get his own way, and kind of the humility behind how he becomes Batman. Like, for me, what makes that stand out is the great scene where he meets Falcone, the bad guy, for the first time. And he just thinks, if I stand up to him, nothing's going to happen. And he gets brought down a peg, like, look, you've got your butler, you've got your friend, you don't realize, you know, there's other ways I can hurt you. And I think a lot of the superhero films kind of miss that real sense of, you know, like dread or things that could happen to you if, you know, you were to take this on. So the likes of The Mask and, like you said, the Batmobile, it just stands out for me. It's just a close to perfect film, not even just a perfect superhero film.
And then the way it ended, Andy, on that amazing cliffhanger, which sets up Batman's great nemesis, the Joker, and then for the Dark Knight to come along, and for the way in which we all know at this stage, the way Heath Ledger then played the Clown Prince was just impeccable. And I know we've gone on and I've bemoaned about the problems I've had with the Dark Knight Rises. For me, I just feel it's the weakest of the three. But in between his Dark Knight trilogy, just before he started work on The Dark Knight Rises, he got to make a passion project of his, which was Inception, of course, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Did a great business at the box office, and its opening weekend it made $60 million. But this was a blockbuster that really didn't dumb things down for the audience. He treated cinema goers as sentient beings, and that they would be able to get on board this particular story that he was going to tell. For you, Andy, though, there's a lot going on. It really is a puzzle box of a movie. Did you feel it worked?
I do and I don't. I think there's a couple of elements to it that really bothered me. Like, Nolan, what he done for like Dark Knight Rises and for Interstellar, he had this habit of like stopping a film in the middle and really have this, you know, intense prologue that essentially he telegraphs what's going to happen at the end of the film. Like, he done it with Dark Knight Rises, where you have the speech with Alfred talking about wanting to see him in the cafe. Interstellar, there's a similar scene. The same with Inception, when they're talking about the totem. And that just really took me out of the film. It was just the way it's kind of shot. It's just the second he starts saying, when the totem doesn't fall, Inception stops for about half an hour before the end of the film. And it's essentially like, you know, previously on Inception, where he goes through where everybody is again. Whereas I feel if you had to cut that section out and just gone kind of straight to the end, it would have been a far better film than it was. That said, it's one of the most inventive, it's one of the most original, like, you know, stealing, you know, or accepting thoughts and dreams, like a high concept. And it's something a really original film that people, again, we've said this a number of times about Nolan, that people don't make anymore.
Yeah.
And I really feel like, you know, he hasn't pigeonholed himself with the Dark Knight. He could have made Batman films or superhero films for the rest of his career. And that kind of bothers me when you see people like James Cameron or you see people like Michael Bay. You know, I know Michael Bay and James Cameron in comparison, I'll probably get shot for that. But to see them do, you know, 5 or 6 Avatar films or 5 or 6 Transformer films, I really appreciate that he took time out from, you know, as franchise to make these original films, because I don't think there's enough talented filmmakers doing that at the moment.
Very true, because like even in between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, he made The Prestige, which was a really, really good thriller, between these two warring magicians. And again, it has one of those endings that leave people kind of going, oh, which one is the clone? You know what I mean? It was a really, really good movie. And then, of course, we have to mention Interstellar as well, which... you know, had again an awful lot of lofty themes going on there, and people seem very split on it. But Dunkirk is coming out soon enough, and he'll be in cinemas in July. What are your expectations for it?
I did, based purely on the trailer. I like with Nolan films as well, as trailers don't give away the whole film like a lot of other people do. This looks really interesting. Like, he's hitting a genre that he's never made before. Like, he's never made a war film before. And based on the kind of footage that we've seen there, like a Nolan action sequence, we've seen it in things like Dark Knight with like the truck flipping. Like, you've seen a truck flipping before, but you haven't seen it the way he does it. I'm very interested to see, like, is he able to kind of rival, you know, the standard bearer for war films or war action scenes, for me, is Steven Spielberg. The first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. And I'm dying to see what Nolan brings, that if he's able to kind of rise to the challenge of that and put his own stamp on it and make, like, you know, a couple of scenes that really ingrain themselves into people as the gold standard of war films.
Yeah, and we've got two Irish actors in there as well. Cillian Murphy returns to work with Nolan again, and then we also have the love-hate actor Barry Keoghan, whose career is just very much on the rise. Andy, thank you so much for taking a look at the career to date of Christopher Nolan. Andy will be back in part two of We Love Movies, as we'll be discussing all the big movie stories from the week. We'll be having the chats about Tom Cruise acting as a tyrant on the set of The Mummy, plus Andy also has the news in regard to the Han Solo spin-off flick. That's all to come on We Love Movies.